600 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Tuesday that Israel's forces will stay in a buffer zone on the Syrian border for the foreseeable future. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Standing atop Mount Hermon, Netanyahu said Israeli troops will remain until another agreement is found to ensure the Jewish state's security. It was apparently the first time a sitting Israeli leader stepped foot that far into Syria. Israel's capture of the demilitarized area in Syrian territories drawing criticism that it's violated a 1974 ceasefire setting up the buffer zone. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric says a deal is a deal.
Occupation is occupation, whether it lasts a week, a month, or a year. It remains occupation.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Amid conflicting reports about Russia's future in Syria, Russian military assets are on the move in Latakia, the home province of fallen dictator Bashar al-Assad and his father. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
Jets and airplanes move off this Russian military base in the Latakia province of Syria. In the news and on the streets, there are conflicting reports about where they are going. Some say they are leaving Syria. Others say they are not. A nearby neighborhood still has shops with signs in Russian, catering to soldiers' needs. Some locals tell us they fear minority groups in Syria will be in danger without Russian protection after the fall of the Bashar al-Assad regime more than a week ago. Others say the Russians' move is a sign that the war is ending. Russia was a close ally of the Assad government, entering the Syrian civil war to defend the regime in 2015. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Latakia, Syria.
This is VOA News. A senior U.S. military official said on Tuesday that a couple hundred North Korean troops fighting alongside Russian forces against Ukraine had been killed or wounded in battle in the Kursk border region. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to provide a U.S. assessment of the war, didn't provide details on exactly how many had been killed. The official says the North Korean forces don't appear to be battle-hardened, which contributes to the number of casualties they've had. The man accused of killing an American healthcare executive was charged on Tuesday with murder as an act of terrorism. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
The defendant is charged with one count of murder in the first degree and two counts of murder in the second degree, including one count of murder in the second degree is an act of terrorism.
Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg at a news conference. Luigi Mangione was already charged with murder in the killing of Brian Thompson, but this terror allegation brought forward by Bragg is new.
This was a frightening, well-planned, targeted murder that was intended to cause shock and attention and intimidation.
Thompson, who was 50, was shot dead as he walked to a Manhattan hotel where Minnesota-based United Healthcare, the United States' biggest medical insurer, was holding an investor conference. I'm Haya Panjwani.
Residents of New Jersey and other eastern U.S. states have been saying for weeks they are seeing thousands of unidentified drones flying overhead. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
The phenomenon has sparked conspiracy theories and demands from lawmakers and some state officials for investigations into what's soaring overhead on the East Coast. Since November, hundreds of people have shared photos and videos online. The majority of reported sightings have come from New Jersey. But people in Maryland, Virginia, Massachusetts, and New York have reported seeing them as well. The White House and the FBI have said the objects pose no threat. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said in a recent interview that there was no question New Jersey residents were seeing some drones, though he said at least some of the sightings were of manned aircraft. New York Governor Kathy Hochul called on Congress to enact stricter rules for drones, while New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy asked President Joe Biden for more resources to investigate the sightings. Some lawmakers have suggested that foreign countries could be dispatching the drones.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
quiet Christmas in the Holy Land.
There's a lot of lights. It's actually very pretty. But there's not really a feeling of celebration.
The plight of Syrian refugees in Europe.
Once a successful businessman in Damascus, Attar left with his family, joining hundreds of thousands of Syrians fleeing to Europe.
And space travel under President Trump.
It's a commercial partnership. It's a international partnership.
Today is Wednesday, December 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. As we reported on Tuesday's show, Israeli forces have moved into a buffer zone in the Golan Heights along the border with Syria. Officials say it's to protect the people who live there. Many are from the Druze minority. For an update on that, plus the fighting in Gaza and a new push for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to end the war and a look at preparations for Christmas in the Holy Land, Steve spoke with VOA's Linda Grandstein in Jerusalem.
Well, there's still fighting going on, especially in northern Gaza. In fact, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, Israeli troops today went into the Indonesian hospital, which is one of the few hospitals still functioning in the north, and told the people there to evacuate, saying that there were Hamas militants who were hiding in the hospital. Patients were evacuated, and Israel attacked the hospital. And the other interesting thing is that about 800 parents of combat soldiers sent a letter today to Prime Minister Netanyahu asking him, demanding that he end the war and, a ceasefire in return for the release of the hostages. There are still 96 Israeli hostages there, both living and dead. At least a third of them, probably more at this point, are dead. So there does seem to be the beginning of kind of criticism of the war in Gaza, which is something we have not seen since it began almost 14 months ago.
Interesting. And does this have anything to do with Netanyahu's political fortunes? I'm thinking of the corruption trial he's recently been in and the judicial reforms he was trying to make before the war started.
Well, I think more and more people believe, even those who are from, at least some from Netanyahu's only Likud party, that he is putting his personal issues above the thing that's really the best for the country. You know, Israelis tend to be very patriotic. There is a lot of support. There was a lot of support for the war. And of course, the hostages issue has been very difficult for a lot of everybody. Israel's a small country. Everybody knows somebody who either is a hostage or was killed on October 7th. So it's very personal for a lot of people. At the same time, there is a sense that there should be a state commission of inquiry into what went wrong on October 7th. In fact, President Isaac Herzog said that today, called for a commission of inquiry. So I think, you know, some of it is political and some of it is just the sense that after 14 months, it's time to end this war. Although apparently Hamas has not yet handed over a list of the hostages who are still alive.
Linda, I'd like to turn our attention now to the north of Israel. You reported on yesterday's show that Israel has taken over a buffer zone in the Golan Heights along the border with Syria. How has the fall of the Assad regime in Syria changed the game?
Well, you know, the Assad regime, from Israel's perspective, was quite stable. I mean, in other words, the border between Israel and Syria was Israel's quietest border for decades. And it might not have been very good for the people of Syria, but Israel knew that they had an address in Assad. Israel had kind of an agreement with Assad about what is acceptable and what is not. And so I think there's a lot of concern in Israel about what does the fall of Assad mean for Israel and for that border. And as I reported, Israel took over this border, this buffer zone in the Golan Heights. There are about 20,000 Druze citizens who are both, there's many of them are Syrian citizens. They live in Israel, they're Israeli residents, but they see themselves as Syrian and they are carefully watching what's going on. I think Israel is concerned, but at the same time, Israel says that it has no territorial ambitions in Syria. It doesn't intend to stay in this buffer zone, unlike Gaza, in fact, where some people say that Israel is kind of preparing to annex the northern part of Gaza, which is the part that's closer to Israel. And, you know, some hardliners in Israel are even calling to reestablish Jewish settlements in Gaza. That's not the case in Syria. So the question is really, there's just more uncertainty than anything else. You know, Ahmed Ashara Julani made a statement that they don't seek war with anybody, including Israel. And that's something that Israel wants to hear. And yet they're still being very careful and waiting to see what happens.
Turning now to Christmas. It's a special day in the Holy Land. What's on tap for Wednesday?
Well, you know, first of all, there's the Midnight Mass in Bethlehem. But the mood is very somber. You know, there are no public celebrations, both in Bethlehem and in the old city of Jerusalem in the Christian quarter. There's some lights up. I drove by the YMCA earlier today, and there's a lot of lights. It's actually very pretty. But there's not really a feeling of celebration. And in Bethlehem, they will have the traditional midnight mass, but, you know, with dignitaries and everything, and local Christians. But not, there are not a lot of tourists here right now. It's still kind of a somber feeling. I mean, I remember thinking about last Christmas and thinking, well, next year will be different. And the fact that there's still a war going on, I think, is hard for people to believe. So, you know, tomorrow is really, you know, the majority of the country is Jewish. And so it's a regular work day. It's not a vacation day or anything.
VOA's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem. Linda, thanks very much for your time tonight.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
Ukrainians attended a Christmas Eve service Tuesday in Kyiv's St. Michael's Cathedral, hoping for victory and peace to come in 2025. Oksana seems to speak for many in Kyiv when she says she wants the fighting to stop so she can see her family in Zaporizhia more often. As believers gathered for the service, air raid sirens interrupted the calm of the Christmas evening. In the central Ukrainian city of Kryvyi Rih, one person was killed and 11 wounded by a ballistic missile strike on an apartment block. Moscow is pushing hard on the 1,000-kilometer front line along Ukraine's east and south, almost 3 years into its full-scale invasion. That's Dmytro. He's a Ukrainian soldier. He, too, is praying for peace. He says that 3 years of war is very tough and that it's difficult to be separated from family. Most Ukrainians are Orthodox Christian. The country's main church agreed in 2024 to discard January 7th as the day of celebration, swapping it instead for December 25th. Katerina works in a local university. She says that Christmas certainly unites all Ukrainians and gives strength and energy to continue fighting for our independence and freedom. It's an inspiration, not just for believers, but for all Ukrainians who live in Ukraine, for all other nationalities that live in Ukraine and support democratic and humane values. For many believers, celebrating Christmas on December 25th means not only joining the West, but distancing from Russia.
Elsewhere in Europe, once a successful businessman in Damascus, Nabil Attar joined hundreds of thousands of fellow Syrians seeking asylum in Europe in recent years. Today, Attar, who has opened a restaurant in the French city of Orléans, is both rejoicing in the flight of longtime dictator Bashar al-Assad and, like many others, wondering about his future. Several European Union countries have suspended asylum procedures for Syrian applicants. Others, like France, are studying the changes. Even as right-wing advocates push for ending asylum for Syrians, rights advocates like Amnesty International say the bloc must not sacrifice would-be refugees for political interests. Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
Nabil Attar has brought a slice of his native Syria to the medieval French town of Orléans. Recipes he learned from his mother. Memories of the homeland he left nearly a decade ago after being extorted, he says, by Bashar al-Assad's government.
We were threatened by some armed people to pay money, and they kidnapped my boy. It was so complicated, and I paid a lot of money to get my son back.
Once a successful businessman in Damascus, Attar left with his family, joining hundreds of thousands of Syrians fleeing to Europe. In Paris, he received training in running a restaurant. In 2018, he and his wife opened Narenj here in Orléans. The name means bitter orange in Arabic. The family received French citizenship. Attar says people here have been welcoming.
We never had any problem. We never faced any... I don't like to use racism, but we never encountered that.
Then came news earlier this month that Assad's regime had collapsed. It triggered celebrations in Orléans, including at Attar's restaurant.
I'm hoping and I believe that Syria would be better, much, much, much better than before. I have no concern about that.
But Syria's regime change is sparking other concerns. Some European Union governments have frozen new Syrian asylum requests, arguing the Assad regime that triggered them no longer exists. France is studying the matter. And at a time of rising anti-immigration sentiment, some European politicians are going further, saying Syrian refugees should go home. Rights groups and many Syrians argue they still face threats. Olivia Sundberg-Diaz is with Amnesty International.
What is most important now should be the safety of Syrian refugees and of people that are seeking protection. This has to be prioritized over political interests.
That debate is echoed in Orléans, where some Syrians are anxious about the new leadership in Damascus. Syrian Dr. Ramez Khadri has been living in Orléans for years.
I'm worried about the country. I'm worried about the future because they're extremists. J'ai peur pour l'avenir.
Attar is more optimistic.
And I know many people that are willing to go back because they couldn't integrate in the society. Asylum, if you have a real reason, they will get it.
He hopes to return to a post-Assad Syria.
I would like to go back and visit my family, my house, see my friends, see the streets, where I worked, where I lived.
But not for good. His life and future, Attar says, are now in France. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Orléans, France.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Iranian state media reports that Iran's government has lifted a ban on access to WhatsApp and Google Play after more than 2 years. The report on Tuesday said the country's Supreme Council of Cyberspace made the decision in a meeting led by reformist President Masoud Pezeshkian, who vowed to remove restrictions on social media. The ban was put in place in 2022 during mass protests against the government over the death of a young woman held by the country's morality police for allegedly violating the strictly enforced dress code.
Taliban leaders in Afghanistan hosted meetings on Tuesday with a high-level delegation from neighboring Pakistan, marking the resumption of such talks after a year-long pause due to terrorism allegations. Pakistan said the delegations focused on enhancing diplomatic, trade, and transit relations between the countries, while the chief Taliban diplomat stated that Kabul desires positive relations with Islamabad.
The Eiffel Tower was evacuated Tuesday morning after a fire alarm was set off by a short circuit in the elevator system between the second floor and the top of the tower. No visitors were harmed and the tower has reopened, but with access no higher than the second floor. An investigation into the cause of the short circuit is ongoing. The Paris police declined to comment on the incident.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Turning now to the United States, the incoming Trump administration inherits efforts by the U.S. space agency NASA to return astronauts to the surface of the moon and is turning to commercial space entrepreneurs for help. VOA's Kane Farbaugh has more.
At a recent press conference on plans by NASA to return astronauts to the surface of the moon, Administrator Bill Nelson pointed out the U.S. Space Agency was not the sole partner in the Artemis program.
It's a commercial partnership. It's a international partnership.
More than 50 countries are signatories to the Artemis Accords, which NASA says is a common set of principles to enhance the civil exploration and use of outer space. China, now the main competitor to NASA and its international partners, is not a signatory and plans to land its own crew on the moon by 2030. NASA wants to get there before China, using technology created by commercial space companies to accomplish the goal.
We're going to have SpaceX flying a lander on the Artemis 3. Artemis 4 is going to be SpaceX, and Artemis 5 is going to be Blue Origin.
But the next mission is not until 2026, when Artemis II will send a crew to orbit but not land on the moon. Astronaut Reid Wiseman is the mission commander.
But we talk about what is success for us, and it is enabling Artemis III.
NASA wants to land near the lunar South Pole to search for ice and water during Artemis III, scheduled for 2027. Nelson says SpaceX founder Elon Musk's experience testing rockets and spacecraft could help Artemis.
Take over, Elon, yes, take over.
So could his relationship with President-elect Donald Trump.
I think that the relationship is going to be a benefit to making sure that the funding for NASA is there.
I'm with Elon Musk. I think we should set our sights further away. We should go to Mars.
Charles Camarda is a retired NASA astronaut and engineer.
And we should only use the moon to advance the technologies for going to Mars.
In 2005, Camarda was on the crew of the first space shuttle mission after the 2003 Columbia disaster, when the orbiter broke up as it re-entered Earth's atmosphere. All seven crew members died. He's concerned about problems with the Orion capsule's heat shield during re-entry in the unmanned 2022 Artemis 1 mission. NASA believes it has fixed the issue and plans to use the Orion capsule to transport astronauts to the moon.
I think this could be the tipping point, and we might move in the right direction, or it might be the end of NASA.
NASA's deputy administrator, former astronaut Pam Melroy, told reporters that making decisions about Artemis before the new administration takes over is important to keep NASA on a timeline to return to the moon before China.
I think that would actually be far worse to defer it.
President-elect Trump announced on social media plans to appoint wealthy entrepreneur and pilot Jared Isaacman to replace Nelson as NASA administrator. Isaacman flew in 2021 and 2024 on SpaceX Dragon capsules around the Earth and is the first commercial astronaut to conduct an activity outside a spacecraft. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
The Vatican was filled with excitement on Christmas Eve as the faithful and tourists gathered to witness Pope Francis inaugurate the Holy Year by unlocking the Holy Door of St. Peter's Basilica, a symbol of hope and redemption in the Catholic faith. Maxwell Emmanuel Ajagwu, a 35-year-old tourist, was in St. Peter's Square for the ceremony.
The Vatican has, calling on the world today to come to reconcile to God, to forgive sins, to make peace with our faith is a big opportunity that I feel every human being, every Christian, being you a Muslim or Christian or whoever, come to God and make peace with God.
The holy doors, representing the doorway to salvation, are opened only during Jubilee years. Pilgrims who pass through them are believed to secure the remission of their sins. American tourist Heather Strittmatter was there to witness the once every quarter century event.
I think it's incredible to be here for such a special occasion that only occurs four times in a century. I'll probably only see it one more time in my life.
The Pope's message for the Jubilee focuses on forgiveness, unity, and debt relief, aligning with the Church's mission to inspire compassion and hope globally as anticipation builds for Jubilee 2025.
Online journalists in chat are voicing frustration over officials' refusal to lift a ban on the use of certain audiovisual content. Authorities at the High Media and Audiovisual Authority, or HAMA, say it's because journalists are reposting videos without the content producer's permission. But journalists say they're being silenced from reporting on critical election issues. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon in this report, narrated for us by Dan Joseph.
Journalists reporting for online media platforms say they are surprised that Chad's High Media and Audiovisual Authority, or HAMA, has refused to respect a December 20th Supreme Court decision ordering an immediate end to a ban on broadcasting online media content. Bello Bakary Mana is the president of the Association of Online Media of Chad. Mana took part in a protest Tuesday against what he calls a deliberate attempt by HAMA to silence Chad's online media. Mana says several hundred online reporters, assisted by local radio, print, and TV journalists, are in Ngadjamena to let the world know that the media is being silenced in Chad. He says they will continue protesting until HAMA stops threatening journalists and lifts what he calls its illegal December 4th ban on the broadcast of online audiovisual content. Bello spoke to VOA via a messaging app. Bello also says only police can compel HAMA to respect the lifting of a ban on the broadcasting of online audiovisual content, but that police are controlled by the government, which ordered the ban. Hama says it prohibited online newspapers from broadcasting audiovisual content because many of the newspapers refused to obey an order earlier this year to stop reposting videos from foreign sources, including international media outlets, without the author or media outlet's permission as required by law. Journalists say the decision, taken before elections on December 29th to mark an end to Chad's three-year transitional period, is an indication the government, through Hama, wants to silence online media that the government has described as highly critical. Hama has always complained that online media regularly publish unverifiable information about President Mahamat Idris Deby. Deby became Chad's transitional president in April 2021 after his father, Idris Deby Itno, was killed in a gun battle with rebels following 30 years in power. Deby was declared the winner of Chad's contested May 6th presidential polls amid opposition and civil society allegations that the victory was stolen. Government officials in Chad complained after the presidential elections that online media were reporting on and posting videos of opposition and civil society members, saying that Deby wants to continue his late father's rule, according to local media. Journalists in Chad say by banning online audiovisual content, Hama wants to silence online media that have been reporting that Deby's Patriotic Salvation Movement, or MPS, wants to use the polls to consolidate its grip on power at all costs. Abderrahmane Barka is president of Hama, created by Chad's government to regulate the media in the Central African state. Barka says Chad's high media and audiovisual authority that he leads noticed that before elections, rich politicians hire media organizations to broadcast campaign messages, and that poses a disadvantage to politicians who don't have a lot of money. He says Hama is reinforcing the law, which requires the media to give equal access without pay to all political parties taking part in elections. Barka spoke on state TV Tuesday. He said Chadian laws do not permit online newspapers to broadcast audiovisual content, but did not comment on whether a Supreme Court decision to lift the ban will be respected. Chad's online journalists say the ban has affected about 60% of their audience, who no longer have access to online media. They say they are surprised that Hama also ordered them to stop broadcasting audiovisual content that they produce locally. Before the ban and ahead of the December 29th elections, Hama suspended all interactive online radio and TV programs, arguing that the media do not have sufficient human resources to produce such programs during election periods, a claim the media deny. Last week, Reporters Without Borders asked Chad to reverse its decision and lift the ban. The media rights group says the job of Hama is regulating and not prohibiting the media from informing, educating, and entertaining their audience. RSF acknowledges that broadcasting content without the consent of the producers is wrong and has asked Chad to allow online reporters to broadcast local content they create. From Moki Edwin Kinzika in Yaoundé, Cameroon, this is Dan Joseph, VOA News.
A prized Christmas delicacy from Spain's treacherous Costa de Marte, or Death Coast, is under threat from climate change and over-harvesting. Reuters' Alice Rizzo introduces us to the gooseneck barnacle.
Known for their unique flavor and the peril involved in gathering them, the crustaceans have long been treasured by Spaniards. Despite state regulations, their decline is also being exacerbated by illegal fishing. The practice has surged because of the barnacle's high market value. During the holiday season, gooseneck barnacles can fetch up to $208 for 2.2 pounds. 36-year-old Roberto Vidal began picking barnacles aged 16.
The Percebero trade on the Costa de Morte is dying. This is due to climate change, absurd laws, illegal fishing, and a lack of workers.
His hometown of Cormi once had between 100 and 200 percebeiros. Now about 30 remain. As the number of barnacle pickers dwindles and their harvest declines, licensed pickers are calling for greater enforcement to deter poachers, safeguard their livelihood, and protect the future of the national delicacy.
That's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting for us today.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Thanks for listening.